NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Free Expression with Jerry Baker.
Hello and welcome to Free Expression from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jerry Baker, editor-at-large of the Journal. If you're not already subscribing to Free Expression, please do sign up wherever you do your podcast listening. This week, is ISIS back? Last weekend, terrorists killed more than 140 people at a concert hall venue in Moscow. Despite initial attempts by Vladimir Putin to connect the attack with Ukraine, it seems certain that this was another episode of Islamist terrorism. U.S. intelligence agencies had warned Russia in advance of the risk of an attack, and shortly afterwards, the group ISKP, Islamic State in Khorasan province as it's known, claimed responsibility. This burgeoning group was behind the bombing of a mosque in Iran in January that killed more than 100 people, and was also responsible for the attack at Kabul airport in 2021 during the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan that claimed the lives of 13 American servicemen and women and 170 Afghan civilians. ISIS, of course, in its original form, once controlled a large swath of territory in Syria and Iraq, and it exercised a reign of terror, which included savage murders, as we are all too familiar with, of American civilians. In 2015, U.S. and other forces routed the group in what seemed to be a conclusive battle at Mosul in Iraq. But this latest spate of terror attacks from this group indicate that a new menace has emerged from ISIS. And this ISKP, as it's called again, are active in Afghanistan and Pakistan. In Afghanistan, they seem to have taken advantage of the withdrawal of U.S. and allied forces from the country in 2021. So who exactly are this apparently new terror group? What sort of threat does ISKP pose to the West? We've seen their global reach already. Are they targeting the United States? And what does the menace emerging from the country the US left less than 3 years ago tell us about our policy and stance in the region? When American forces left Afghanistan, President Joe Biden assured us that the US would maintain a, quote, over-the-horizon capability to deal with any threats. How realistic has that proved to be? Well, with me, I'm glad to say, to talk about all this week is Sami Sadat. Lieutenant General Sadat was a senior officer in the Afghan army, rising to command the military's special operations forces in the final days before the country fell to the Taliban in 2021. He now lives in exile, but he's vowed to overthrow the Taliban and establish genuine democratic rule in Afghanistan. And General Sadat joins me now. General, thanks very much indeed for joining Free Expression.
I'm glad to be here, Jerry.
Can we start a little bit with your own background? Because it's a fascinating personal story you have. I know from your own father, who I think was in the Afghan forces that originally fought the Taliban, and you grew up in Afghanistan and dealing with some of the excesses of the Taliban. Can you just tell us about your own family background and how you came to ultimately to have such a senior position in the Afghan armed forces?
Thank you, Jerry. So I'm born and raised in Afghanistan, but after 9/11, I had a chance to go to the Western world and study. I was enrolled in the military school in Germany and then graduated and went back to Afghanistan, joined the Afghan armed forces, and went to Poland, to Polish Defense University, then went to the U.S. for intelligence studies and special operations studies. Ultimately, I finished my military studies in the United Kingdom, graduating from the UK Defense Academy and finishing my war college. I joined the Afghan army following my father's footstep, and I joined the army to clean our country from the extremism. And as you know, Afghanistan is suffering from the extremism problem for the last four decades. And we are the second generation of Afghans fighting extremism and trying to and put our country on the right path. For the last two decades, we have managed to find our path and grow a little bit. As we were standing on our feet, unfortunately, the collapse happened again. So I'm still trying. I'm leading a political organization. It's a political and military organization called Afghanistan United Front. Basically, I have tried to collect the Afghan special forces, the young Afghan generals, young politicians. We have organized ourselves into a team in an organization to go back and free our country. My experience with Taliban, when I was very young, the Taliban put me in jail I was about 14 years old because my father was against them and they arrested me and put me in jail. And a firsthand experience of how they were torturing kids. And the Taliban would teach us in this miners' prison. And some of our teachers were Egyptians. Later I found out those were Al-Qaeda members that the Taliban brought to indoctrinate Afghan children. So in that prison cell, I decided to get out of here and become a fighter and, you know, go and assassinate the Taliban. But, you know, luck was on our side and I became an army officer. Then I became a general and I led big battles against the Taliban, to which I'm proud and I'm grateful. And I am reorganizing to do it again.
And you were there, I'm sorry to say, right at the end, right when US and other NATO forces finally pulled out of Afghanistan in that chaotic withdrawal back in the summer of 2021.
That's right. So many people are betrayed once, but I'm betrayed twice because I was fighting in southwestern Afghanistan in Helmand province as a commander of the 215th Afghan Army Corps, whereby the Taliban poured in from Iran and Pakistan and tried everything to overtake that province. They were supposed to take that province first before every other province, but they couldn't take it until the end. On the 13th of August, I was recalled to Kabul to leave my command position and come to Kabul because they said Kabul was falling apart. So I arrived in Kabul on the 14th of August. On the 15th, I was also given the responsibility to defend the city of Kabul, and the president took a chopper and left me on the ground. So then I was left with none of my combat soldiers, none of my loyal commanders. Some of the best people I fought with was in southwestern Afghanistan in my corps. And then the whole collapse happened. I couldn't go back to my previous post because we didn't have the aircraft to go there and the US forces wouldn't take me. So
how did you get out?
Well, I was also injured. So then I was evacuated by the Royal Air Force of the United Kingdom, to which I'm very grateful. And they brought me to the UK. They treated me. And then I ever since stayed here. I traveled to US from time to time for work. And generally, I'm traveling around trying to organize the younger generation of Afghan leaders. We call ourselves the 9/11 generation, the generation that grew in the last two decades. And we want us to go back to our home and free our country from the Taliban.
I want to talk more about the Taliban and what's going on there and what your efforts to topple them. I want to talk particularly, obviously, about ISIS-K, ISIS Khorasan, and the threat that they pose. We've just obviously seen this horrific attack in Moscow last week, which killed more than 130 people. You know, initially, Vladimir Putin seemed to sort of try and link it to Ukraine, but it seems to be pretty clear. U.S. intelligence warned Russia that there was a risk this was about to happen. ISIS-K themselves claimed responsibility for it. And of course, they are a terrorist organization that operates, you know, in and around Afghanistan, Pakistan too. They were behind the bombing in Iran. Who are ISIS-K? Where did they come from? What's their relationship to the original ISIS that, you know, we thought we'd defeated back in 2015 in Iraq? And what's their relationship to the Taliban? Just give us your sense of who they are.
Jerry, Vladimir Putin's initial finger pointing is understandable. But actually, it's not correct because he's in fight with Ukraine, and obviously he would immediately jump on the conclusion for that. But this is an ISIS attack. Every hallmark, the way they were recruited, the way they were shooting the civilians, it is ISIS. ISIS claimed responsibility for this, and it is most likely that this has happened from Afghanistan or Pakistan, managed by ISIS-K. ISKP, we call it, Islamic State in Khorasan Province. Islamic State in Khorasan Province is the branch of ISIS that is named after the territory of Khorasan, which is an old name for Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and Central Asia. It used to be its own empire a long time ago. So they also have a prophecy that they link to, you know, saying that Prophet Muhammad had said that the ultimate victory will come from Khorasan with people with black flags and all that. This is actually a made up hadith. It's not a real thing. You know, people made this up. Very quickly after the initial ISIS was established in June 2014 in Iraq and Syria, in Afghanistan, a bunch of Pakistani fighters led by Oruzgis they have pledged allegiance to ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and they started reorganizing themselves in that style. Since then, a couple of their leaders were killed by the U.S. and Afghan special forces, and they were defeated in eastern Afghanistan. And we took thousands and thousands of prisoners, and we put them in jail. And their leader in 2019 was called Aslam Farooqi, a Pakistani citizen, was arrested in Kandahar. Coincidentally, I led that operation from JSOC at a time to arrest Aslam Farooqi with 38 of his other affiliates, including four Russian women. There was a Punjabi woman with him, and there was his deputy, his operation guy, his intelligence guy. So we got lucky. We got the entire cell. And after we got this cell, the only one active cell that remained in Afghanistan was the branch that was led by Sanaullah Ghaffari, was not a senior figure at the time. So the rest of them came together and pledged allegiance to this Afghan man. For the first time, the ISIS ISKP leadership was handed over to an Afghan person in 2020. Their relationship with the main ISIS in 2016 to 2020 was pretty strong. They would get strategic direction, but planning operations, targeting, and everything else was done through themselves. However, they continue to get money from Syria and Iraq. And the last chunk of money they continued to receive until the end of 2020 was from Africa, from Somali. And a U.S. led an operation and they arrested the financier. And since then, they have been relying on Afghan and Pakistani sources. Because the ISIS and ISKP and ISIS in Africa and all of them have one media platform, it's called Amaq. So usually they make the statement and people think that they make the statement out of Syria. This is not true. After 2020, we have seen a dramatic, after the death of al-Baghdadi, we have seen a dramatic weakening, even complete elimination of ISIS in Iraq and Syria with, U.S., Iraqis, Russians, Iranians, everybody was involved against them. So they have become dramatically weakened, and consecutive leaders, as they would appoint their leaders, they'd be killed immediately after a few months. Turkey got involved. Turkey killed one of their leaders, arrested another leader. So they didn't have a safe space. In 2021, they tried to move to Africa and establish their caliphate over there. Africa was not safe for them, so they turned to the Khorasan province, as they call it. Today, as we speak, beginning of 2022 until the end of 2023, we have been following a trail of ISIS fighters moving to Afghanistan-Pakistan region. Initially in 2002, a lot of their low-level fighters, the Central Asians, the Russians, the Chechens, and others moved in. In 2023, as they found out that this was safe and this was a good place for them to move, a lot of Arab fighters, and there's a couple of Canadian fighters, European fighters, African fighters also moved to Balochistan of Pakistan, whereby their senior leaders still remain in Balochistan of Pakistan, but their low-level fighters go to Afghanistan.
General, do we have a sense of how many fighters they have, you know, how well trained they are, what their capabilities are?
So in terms of the numbers, the intelligence I've got through our network in the region, it's estimated that they have over 7,000 fighters.
How does that compare with ISIS, the ISIS that we were fighting, you know, from that sort of period of, you know, 2011 to 2015?
I think that's considerably lower number, but given the geography and given the locality of where these fighters are, this could be deadly. And remember, when all the world was fighting ISIS, the entire, all the great nations, superpowers, but today nobody's fighting ISKP. They are, you know, doing their own thing. And the geography of Afghanistan, the mountains, the valleys, is incredibly difficult to fight.
And they're mostly in Afghanistan, but also Pakistan. So
most of their leadership right now is located in Panjgur area of Balochistan. And this is an interesting area, Jerry, because this is 100 miles to the west of the Persian Gulf and 150 kilometers to the east of Kandahar in Afghanistan. And it's also around 200 kilometers from Balochistan of Iran. And this is a very strategic area whereby you could freely move into Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and also through the Karachi port with a lot of ships moving in and out. You can actually go to Iraq and Somalia and other places. And this has been the route that they are using. Because, you know, the Pakistani government is very corrupt. So a lot of these fighters actually go through the shipyards and they use the ships to go around. Ironically, I have not seen or heard any operation planned by the Pakistanis against ISKP, suggesting that there is some kind of a coordination or understanding. The same group that resides in Pakistan attacks Afghanistan and Iran, but they do nothing with Pakistan. This year, according to the internal communication of ISKP that we have access to, they are trying to get territory in Afghanistan, but they also want to continue to disrupt and conduct large-scale attacks in Iran. In fact, they moved a lot of explosives to Iran. And one would think, why are they going after Iran? There's two reasons. One, they're the Shia Muslims, which the ISKP members think they're not, you know, they don't consider the Shias as Muslims. The second reason is because a lot of their leadership was killed by Iranians in Syria, so they're taking revenge from the Iranian clergy.
Would that also maybe explain why they target Russia in the way that they seem to have done last week? Because, of course, as you said earlier, Russia was very much involved in that effort to defeat Islamic State back in 2015.
Absolutely, because the Russians have denied them territory in Syria and because the Russians have killed a lot of ISIS fighters. ISIS is looking for revenge in Russia. But there is also another reason is because in Russia, they have channels. Remember from the day one when ISIS was established in Iraq, a lot of Central Asian fighters moved in and joined the ranks. In fact, their international brigade was overwhelmingly manned by the Central Asian fighters from Uzbekistan, from Kazakhstan. Even the head of the Tajikistan Special Forces called Murad Khalimov joined ISIS in 2015, and their relationship with the Central Asia had since then been kept intact. And now that they don't have a lot of space in Syria and Iraq, in fact, they have very, very limited space in Syria and Iraq. So what do? They move back to Afghanistan and get close to Central Asia because we have open up border with Central Asia. They can cross in and out, and the Taliban don't have the capacity or the surveillance that we used to have. So their relationship with Russia is twofold. First, they are looking to avenge some of their comrades that was killed by the Russian Air Force and the mercenaries on the ground in Syria. The second is that a lot of these come from the countries whereby Russians have occupied their countries for the longest time. Yeah. And so their sworn enemy is Russia.
We're going to take a short break there. When we come back, I'll have more with Lieutenant General Sami Sadat of the Afghan Army, talking about the threat that Islamist terrorism, particularly ISKP, pose around the world, and also how we might be able to deal with that threat before we see another major attack. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
You're listening to Free Expression with Jerry Baker. Don't forget, you can listen to the latest episode anytime on your smart speaker. Just say, play the Opinion Free Expression podcast. Now, back to Jerry Baker.
Welcome back. I'm in conversation with Lieutenant General Sami Sadat, a commander in the Afghan army. We're talking about the new terror threat that seems to be emerging from Afghanistan in the shape of the group called ISKP. We've seen the attack on the mosque in Iran in January. We've now seen this huge attack in Moscow. I fear we have to assume that ISIS-K, ISKP, the terrorists will be looking to target other places in the West, and not to be too focused on ourselves about it, but on the United States and maybe Western Europe. Do you think they have the ability to project that kind of terror threat beyond the sort of the Eurasian landmass?
As I see the intelligence and the trend, and given their background, they have capabilities in Europe, and it's highly likely that they will conduct attacks in Europe. In the United States, I'm not aware whether or not they have the ability. They definitely have the intent. In Europe, a Moscow-style attack is possible. In the United States, probably lone wolf attacks is also possible given their circumstances.
The U.S. intelligence does acknowledge that quite a significant number of suspected terrorists are feared to have come into the United States. As you know, here in the United States, we have a very serious problem with our southern border. Again, I don't want to be too ghoulish about this, but one can presumably suspect that, you know, among some of the people who are coming from all over the world, you know, through and across the southern border, some of them will have very evil intent. And it's conceivable, I suppose, given ISIS-K's capabilities and ambitions, that they could possibly get into the United States that way.
That is possible, and that's probable. I think the next 2 weeks is very important because this is the month of Ramadan, and basically some of the extremists go on steroids because of the importance, and that this is a holy month, and they will try to do crazy things. I would think Europe might be the next target because they also want to poke, given that Europe and Russia are at fight, they want to poke both sides or to increase the fraction between the Western world. But I will come back to this, that all of this is now being managed from ISKP. There is no more ISIS with their leadership as it used to be. You see, in a Moscow-style attack, ISIS should have a fatwa, which is a religious ruling. Nobody can operate or conduct an attack on another country, particularly if they don't have a religious ruling. And the religious ruling is issued by their council of ulamas, which they call it lajna. And the Lajna for Islamic State has moved in 2023 from Syria to Balochistan of Pakistan. So they're operating in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and they should have issued the fatwa from over there. Also, given the connection with the Tajikistan fighters, it is likely that these fighters were recruited from in Afghanistan and then sent to Russia via different channels. The trouble for Russia is that through Afghanistan, there is a network of smugglers that are taking drugs from Afghanistan to Tajikistan to then to Russia. And this is an established route. So it's easy for them to use the same route and continue to conduct attacks. The same is true for Iran, because all of the drugs produced in Afghanistan are going through two different routes. One is through Central Asia to Russia. The other one is through Iran to Turkey and then to the rest of the Europe. So I believe that ISKP will unleash a lot of attacks this summer, particularly in Iran, Afghanistan, and they will try to hit Europe and the United States, and they will continue to try to hit Russian cities as well.
What's their relationship with the Taliban? Again, it's obviously different from the United States. Obviously, was struck by Al-Qaeda on 9/11 and in the previous attacks. Al-Qaeda obviously were given a kind of a safe haven, weren't they, in Afghanistan by the Taliban back then, pre-9/11. The ISKP have a different relationship. They're not closely aligned with the Taliban in the way that Al-Qaeda were. And in fact, I think notionally at least, Taliban are supposed to be trying to defeat ISKP. But what's the situation there? Are the Taliban turning a blind eye to them? Are they in some way even maybe even kind of encouraging them? What's your sense of what their relationship is?
The current leader of ISKP, Sanaullah Ghaffari, used to be a Haqqani operative. So he used to work for the Haqqani network. In 2019, he was tasked by the leader of Haqqani network, Sirajuddin Haqqani, to go join ISKP and infiltrate and continue to attack Kabul City, the Americans and Afghans, and claim responsibility under ISKP's name, because by then the Doha Agreement had been signed and the Taliban have agreed not to attack at least major cities or the American forces. So they used Sanaullah Ghaffari to become ISIS and continue their attacks, which they did. And ultimately, they became very, very lucky when we arrested the rest of the ISKP leadership, and Sanaullah Ghaffari became a leader of ISKP. But he then went rogue and he became an important figure in a different organization. And since then, he has not been listening or working or cooperating with the Taliban. I would believe that he still has some sort of relationship with Sarajuddin Haqqani, the leader of Haqqani Network, but they are arch enemies with one another. The trouble is the Taliban do not have the sophistication to keep a check on the ISKP, and the ISKP is spread between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and in a lot of places where they are, the Taliban do not have access. Also, the Taliban have not been aggressive and preemptive against ISKP to stop them from regrouping or training or preparing. They are only going after ISKP when there is an imminent threat of ISKP coming at the Taliban.
Okay, so again, they don't have an alliance with the Taliban, but the Taliban are really not making any strenuous efforts to try and restrain them.
Absolutely right. Yes, the Taliban are doing nothing to stop ISKP from conducting attacks overseas. And they are doing nothing with Al-Qaeda as well, which is basically their friend at the time.
What do you expect Iran to do? I mean, the larger question is, how do we deal with this threat? If these attacks keep happening, and you've said very clearly you expect there to be more in the region and possibly further afield in Europe and maybe even in the United States in the course of the next few months, what do we do? I mean, again, we saw what happened after 9/11. The U.S. warned the Taliban that if they didn't hand over Al-Qaeda, the U.S. would immediately attack. And of course it did, and then was in Afghanistan for 20 years. What do you think the Russians will do? What will the Iranians do? And how, in the end, do we deal with this threat?
So the Iranians has already conducted overseas missile strikes against ISKP and the affiliates. Remember, Iranians hit targets in Pakistan. This is exactly the area where ISKP is, and they tried to hit ISKP, which they missed. So it is probable that Russia might also use their air force and missiles against particular ISKP and targets. I would imagine the Russian generals are working on this as we speak, because Russia will not shy away from going to another country and bombing them because the threat came from that country, as Iran did. I think ISKP will continue to hit Iran, and Iran will continue to respond in a way that they did. And I think Russia will join it. I think if the threat of ISKP increases, as the trend shows right now, you will very soon see Iranian jet fighters bombing Pakistan, Afghanistan, Russian jet fighters, you know, bombing other countries. And this will lead into a larger fight. We have seen that how a small terrorist organization can bring many countries to fight each other. Case in point, Hamas, small organization with a small number of operatives, attacked Israel. Today, there is more than a dozen countries fighting each other in the Middle East. What was supposed to be a small attack by a terrorist and has now consumed different powers of the world on each side, entrenched to fight with one another. ISKP has the capability to do the same. And let's not forget Al-Qaeda that is preparing in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda actually has 2 times more fighters than ISKP does. And the difference with Al-Qaeda is Al-Qaeda has no interest in Afghanistan. They have taken Afghanistan. So their next move, they're already fueling the attacks in Pakistan, and they are supporting TTP to the full extent to go and overpower the Pakistani military. Of course, Al-Qaeda has allyship with Iran, and they have no animosity with Russia, and the Taliban are their friends. So they only point to the Middle East and the Western world. The future of terrorism points to a dark point in the next chapter, whereby they could not only damage the rest of the world's stability by themselves, but actually they could cause friction amongst the global powers and other countries to fight each other. How do we get rid of this? I think we should go back to the basics, Jerry. You know, I believe the only way to fight them is to empower Afghans to bring back a responsible government whereby, you know, we could holistically go after this terrorist problem, and we could be a responsible country cooperating with the region, cooperating with the United States and the rest of the world. This problem will not go away. And some people say, oh, we spent 20 years and this and that. Well, unfortunately, this is like a cancer-like of a problem. If you have cancer and you treat yourself for a year, if it doesn't go away, what do? You stop taking medication? I think this is exactly what we did. I think this is exactly what the United States did. Like, oh, well, you know, let's stop taking medication and see if the problem will go away. The problem will not go away anywhere. Only the Afghans standing on their feet could defeat this terrorism. At least if we couldn't defeat it in the rest of the world, we could actually concise it into the region whereby we continuously fight them and not allow them to spread into the rest of the world as we did in the past 20 years.
But you'd need significant support. First of all, the US is never going back into Afghanistan, is it? I mean, Donald Trump signed the original deal with the Taliban. President Biden withdrew US forces from Afghanistan. There's bipartisan agreement on that. Secondly, you see how difficult it is to get political consensus to support Ukraine and its fight against Russia. There really isn't the sentiment in the United States, you know, unfortunately, particularly unfortunately for you and your people, General, to provide the kind of support that I would imagine you would need to take back Afghanistan. Isn't that the reality?
We don't need significant support. We do not need U.S. soldiers to come and fight for us. We have a lot of stuff already. The Afghan Air Force is fully intact, and we took all our aircraft into Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. We have billions of dollars printed in Afghan currencies sitting in Poland and other countries, and we don't want foreign soldiers to come back to Afghanistan and fight our war. We are completely capable of fighting this war ourselves if, you know, the foreign countries stop interfering but actually listen to us and support us politically and with some material support. Then we can go and solve the problem. If the United States didn't sign a deal with the Taliban and they evacuated signing a deal with us, the Taliban would have never been able to take over Afghanistan. What actually put us on our knees was the Doha deal. Our best friend went and dated with our enemy behind our back and then cut all the logistical support, the legitimacy and everything that was supposed to be given to the allies, turned its tail and left. And then, of course, things started crumbling and the speed was staggering speed. So we couldn't organize ourselves. Of course, we are to be blamed as well. We had some coward leaders. We had some corrupt politicians. The country was divided and we were sick and tired of all the bickering between different leaders and parties. I think the United States and the rest of the world could safely invest on the new generation of Afghan leaders, and it will be very different. And of course, we don't want interference. We don't want others to tell us what to do. We know exactly what to do. We know the world. We know our people. We know the problem, and we are more than willing to go and solve the problem. But this is not the problem that we can solve by ourselves. We need a little bit of help to go after this problem.
Finally, General, and this has been a fascinating conversation, when U.S. forces withdrew from Afghanistan in that crazy and chaotic period, and by the way, I should say, as I noted at the in my introduction, that it was ISKP, of course, who carried out that attack at the airport, and that which killed 13 U.S. servicemen and women and I think 170 Afghan civilians. When that happened, President Biden said, we're still very focused on any threat of terrorism from Afghanistan. And they talked about using a, remember the phrase, over the horizon capability to deal with terrorism. They didn't need to be on the ground there in Afghanistan to deal with it. They would be able to somehow, whether, you know, long-range missiles or bombers or whatever, would be able to deal with the threat. It sounds from everything you're saying that that just isn't very credible, that without, as you say, ultimately toppling the Taliban regime, the ability of the United States or indeed Russia or indeed even Iran, a neighbor, to actually eliminate this terrorist threat from outside the country is far-fetched.
It is. And over the horizon was a hypothesis that became a program, and it was conducted out of Qatar. Even when the Americans were in Afghanistan after 2020 until 2021, for over a year, this program was experimented and tried, and it didn't work. And it didn't work because of technical reasons and also because of political reasons and also because of the communication. So technically, when you're flying a drone from Qatar to Afghanistan, it takes about 20 hours. So drones are not very fast. You need to refuel the drone midair before it reaches Afghanistan. When it does reach Afghanistan, you get about 2 hours of flying time before you fly back to base for another 20 hours. So 40 hours of route and then 2 hours of on the mission. Now, when you're on the mission, you need effective communication with the ground forces. if you don't have effective communication with the ground forces, you have just wasted your time, or you can strike somewhere and you could kill a bunch of civilians. The other problem was the political problem. So I was in Helmand in June 2021, and I was yelling at the American CSRs, like, where is the air support? I need drones, at least eyes. If you are not bombing it, just tell me where they are so I could send, you know, ground forces. And they said, well, Sami, we only can send 3 drones a day to Afghanistan. I said, why? Because we used to have 40 drones to compare it before the Doha deal. Every day in the Afghan sky was providing eyes to the rest of the forces. Not all of them were conducting strikes, but all of them were surveilling and providing good information, which would save lives. So the American CSAR told me in Doha that the country of Oman decided to only allow 3 drones a day to pass their airspace going into Afghanistan. So if you're flying from Qatar, you're cutting through 3 countries before reaching Afghanistan. And any of those countries at any moment given in time and without a notice, they could say, well, sorry, you cannot fly anything tonight or today through our airspace because our Sultan is flying from X to Y. Or from now on, you're not allowed to fly military drones from one country to another. So over the horizon, program has completely failed. And this experiment and this idea never worked. And the one success I would point out they had was with killing Zawahiri, which was a one single target, one person. But if you're going after an organized, systematic terrorist groups, you need people on the ground. You need a friendly, responsible government on the ground. And this is not possible with the Taliban. And therefore, there is a need to oust the Taliban and replace the Taliban regime with an Afghan responsible government that, you know, are the allies to America, to our neighbors, and to the rest of the world. And it's not a rocket science. We will do it ourselves. We just need a little bit of space.
Yeah. General, it sounds tragically as though we're condemned to repeat history here. It looks as though that, you know, just as we did before 9/11, we're unfortunately standing by as a terror threat emerges in Afghanistan, despite all the things we've learned over the last 20 years. Unless, as you say, we can do what you urge, you know, we may be condemned to repeat that history. Lieutenant General Sami Sadat, Afghan Army Commander, thank you so much indeed for joining Free Expression.
Thank you, Jerry. Have a great day.
You too. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks very much indeed for joining Free Expression. Please do join us again next week. In the meantime, have a very happy Easter, and I look forward to speaking to you next week. Goodbye.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.